Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Deborah Freeman, and on behalf of LaRouche PAC, I'd like to welcome all of you to today's event. Certainly, there is no moment more dramatic for our nation, and in fact for the world, than this one. And it is indeed fitting that after the stunning defeat of the bailout package, if you will, by the House of Representatives just a couple of days ago, that we would be hosting this event today. It is my understanding that we have the largest audience gathered around the world that we have ever had. That doesn't surprise me, but I don't want to keep them waiting. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, please join me in welcoming the statesman and economist, Lyndon LaRouche.
Thank you. We have come into times like those you have never in your lifetimes experienced before. As a matter of fact, there's nothing in all modern European history globally extended to compare with what is happening globally and in the United States as well right now. There's been nothing like the crisis that faces us today since a comparable crisis in Europe during the medieval period called the New Dark Ages. We are on the verge of a complete collapse of the entire planet into a new dark age. On the 25th of July last year, I announced that we were on the edge of the beginning of a breakdown crisis in the U.S. economy. At that point, I indicated that measures that would have to be taken to deal with this crisis which was going to hit us, measures which, if they had been taken between the 25th of August and recently, we would not be in the crisis we're in today. We're in a crisis today because people like Senator Dodd and bailout Barney in the House of Representatives prevented the actions which I had specified, which would have prevented the kind of crisis which the nation is and its people are suffering today. So if you don't like what's happening, blame bailout Barney and Chris Dodd. Chris Dodd's a stooge for Felix Rohatyn, one of the worst right-wingers in our country today. Now, I also indicated proposal for certain other actions, in addition to the warning, which should be taken by the United States to avert and begin the correction of this problem. The first was known as the Householders and Bank Protection Act of 2007, which was specified at that time and was actually set into motion as a formal proposition in early September of that same year. This had much support at the state level throughout and counties throughout the United States. It was voted up by county organizations and state organizations, but it was never formally adopted because of the blocking from interest-controlling people like Dodd and bailout Barney. So we are in a crisis because bailout Barney and Dodd and people like them acted to prevent this action occurring, which would have saved our banks, which are now in trouble, and which would have saved the homeowners who are threatened with continuing and accelerating evictions today. This is one of the reasons why the House of Representatives displayed such hatred against the Congress as a whole in the recent vote on Monday against the bailout bill. Now, the bailout bill might be voted up. The danger is that a desperate Bush administration and what it's tied to internationally might try to make a military suppression of resistance to their policy now. They might try to use military force to force through the kind of legislation, the bailout, which is being attempted now. But the other side of this proposition, apart from other measures which I've indicated earlier and will repeat here again today, the essential irony of this situation is that this is no longer the kind of crisis which the lying government we have and the stupid president we have been talking about. This is not a mortgage crisis. This is a collapse, a disintegration of the entire international monetary financial system. Something that has never happened in European experience before, and for which there's no one competent in the White House right now. We are on the verge of a global hyperinflation like that hit in October of 1923 in Weimar Germany. When you start talking about 700 billion, then a trillion, then 2 trillion, then $3 trillion, then $7 trillion for this bailout, which is the direction we're going in, you're talking about a Weimar style blowout of the entire international financial monetary system. And what's the problem now is that the bailout method itself is the driving force of hyperinflation, global hyperinflation. And what you have a sense like the French Revolution, in which the Marquis de Lafayette had the correct position politically with a tennis court oath and similar kinds of things. But he lacked one thing. He lacked the guts to take on his own king. The king had been totally corrupted by a number of measures. The king was not too bright. You've got to let him off a little bit. He's kind of stupid. He's good at making clocks and fixing clocks, but he was not very good at politics. And his wife, Marie Antoinette, who was the sister of the Emperor of Austria, was framed up by a British operation called the Queen's Necklace Affair. She was humiliated publicly, and the Emperor of Austria, who had been a friendly fellow, a progressive fellow relative to the rest of his relatives prior to that point, went berserk. So what happened is that the French king, who is a bit of a jerk, brought in foreign, not French troops to occupy the area around Paris, to suppress the French people. And this led to what became, inevitably, the French Revolution, the bloody French Revolution, because of this kind of mistake. We are on the verge of things like that today. You have a situation in which, as you saw with the House of Representatives vote against this bill, despite all the pressure on the representatives, and the pressure was not just on from the representatives, it was from the people who are represented. It's the people out there that hate this. And there's an instinct in this administration to use military force against the people of the United States to suppress the opposition to this bill. That is reality right now. Not something coming down, that is already the reality. If this bill were to be pushed through, even with or without the aid of military force against the American people by American troops, which are now being stationed for this kind of operation, the United States would disappear in very short order, and civilization would crash globally. The world would go into a dark age like that of a similar situation in Europe's 14th century, during which, within a period of a generation, the number of parishes in Europe collapsed by one half. the level of population of all Europe collapsed by one-third, and mass insanity dominated the population of Europe at that time. That was the end of the authority of the feudal imperial system which had ruled Europe from about 1000 AD up until that point. We are on the verge of a situation in which, if the bill is pushed through, the chain reaction effects of the bill will ensure that the population of this planet drops from about 6.5 billion people to less than 2. And that in a fairly short period of time. Entire languages will disappear, entire countries will disappear as entities, and we will go through a dark age worse than Europe experienced in the 14th century. Now, there's some people in the Congress and elsewhere say, we're frightened, you can't do this, don't you know what you're doing? You can't do this, we can't vote against this bill. Why, they'll kill us. If American troops, ordered by the president, turn on the American people to suppress this opposition to this bill, the United States will cease to exist. This is worse than treason. Any such action from any part of government is worse than treason. And anyone who accepts such an order is a traitor to the United States. So that's the situation we face. Now, what are the remedies? What are the alternatives? There are some excellent alternatives, but there are no alternatives for Wall Street. Wall Street has earned its death. It is a dead, stinking fish lying in the streets of Lower Manhattan. The investment banking system is dead, and it should have been killed before it rotted into death. So this is our particular problem. Now, if we want to save the country and save civilization and avoid a dark age, there are some very elementary remedies, some of which I've already stated earlier, a year ago. One is, as I said, we must keep the homeowners in their houses. No evictions. We can make other arrangements to manage the downsizing of the debt, because most of the mortgage debt is fraudulent. That is, the agencies which generated this level of indebtedness, this level of housing prices, committed by fraud against the nation. Therefore, they are not entitled to the full price of the mortgage in any case. But what the full price should be, we don't know. But we'll find out. We will put this housing situation under bankruptcy protection by the federal government, with cooperation of state government and local government. People will stay in their homes if they wish to, if they are actually the mortgage holder. Because we must also keep the banks in function. Now, we have a problem here. In 1999, when Clinton was in deep trouble because of the frame-up against him by Republicans and others who were trying to stop his attempt to make a change in the financial structure. Remember at the time, back in 1998, there was a great collapse of a speculative bubble which was created about the Yeltsin candidacy for re-election in Russia, the GKO cases. So at that point, the system was collapsing. I warned the government at that time that the collapse was on. It was inevitable. And the president at that time, this is in August, agreed with me that this was the problem. He moved with the Secretary of Treasury at that time to initiate what became the intent to launch a change in the architecture of our financial monetary system, to eliminate this factor of corruption and to create remedies for it. However, at that time, there was a frame-up organized by forces which were opposed to this reform, which moved toward the impeachment of President Clinton. So President Clinton, during the following year, was living most of his time under the dictatorship of Al Gore, who was acting as the man in occupation of the White House. And the ability of the president, Bill Clinton, to deal with these kinds of problems, which were building up in the year 1999, was limited. Under these conditions and a confused and corrupted Congress, and it was confused and corrupted, the repeal of Glass-Steagall occurred. If Glass-Steagall had not been repealed, we would not be in the kind of crisis we're in today. We should restore Glass-Steagall immediately. That's one of the things the Congress should do. But that's not enough. There are new problems in addition to those addressed by Glass-Steagall, which have been created by this process. So therefore, we have to have a larger piece of legislation, and I'll get to that. I also proposed a protection for our banking system in terms of currency. I propose that we have a basic minimal 4% interest rate as the lending rate for our banking system, except in cases of government projects, which are in the national interest, government projects certified by the Congress, which would have a lower rate of borrowing. That would have protected us against some of the worst things that went on this period. Now, the third thing, which is the big one, which is of crucial importance right now, is I propose that the United States approach Russia, China, and India as the big four power of this planet, not to establish a dictatorship by these four powers, but to take a group of four nations, which aggregately are so powerful, the world has to listen to them and obey some of the suggestions they make. They would immediately be supported in these kinds of measures by Japan, by Korea, and by some nations in Europe, some forces in Italy, some forces in France, like President Sarkozy of France right now. The thing there is a movement in Italy, also organized by the finance minister of Italy, which is moving in the same direction. The Italian motion is directly done in my name. That is the idea of a new Bretton Woods, as my policy is specified by a motion, a bill, presented in the Italian Senate now for a new Bretton Woods system. Now, that is the solution, the key to the solution to this situation internationally. We have a world system. The entire system is bankrupt. The entire world monetary financial system is already in a Weimar-style hyperinflationary takeoff. We are weeks or so away from a crisis beyond belief. And all the troops that Bush might wish to deploy to the streets to try to get that bill through will not save the United States from destruction by the effects of his doing that. Therefore, we need the cooperation of Russia, China, and India as a big four around which other nations can gather and simply get rid of the opposition to doing this. It's in the interest of the people of the world, so why not mobilize the major part of the world's population in these and other nations combined? And let's say the people of the world, through their respective national governments, agree this is going to be stopped. What would we do? We would take a leaf out of the book of President Franklin Roosevelt, who's much smarter than these jerks that we now have in government today. And has some better supporters then, too. We would then say we're going to set up, as what the language is, in Russia, in Italy, and from the president of France and from others, a new Bretton Woods system. And they mean a new Franklin Roosevelt Bretton Woods system. Nothing different. The difference between that and what Truman did is notable. What Roosevelt did, Roosevelt followed the Constitution. Now, let me explain what the problem was then, because it's relevant to understanding the problem today. Roosevelt's intention during the war was to engage in a reluctant alliance with the British in order to crush the Nazis and some other pestilences running loose. But Roosevelt's intention was also at the end of the war, to eliminate colonialism and everything like it from the planet. Now, we had had, as some of you are old enough to remember, very few of you, I guess, it'd have to be my generation and so forth to remember that, we had launched to, as a recovery measure from the depression created by Coolidge and Hoover and people like that, which we used as our mobilization, with the role of Harry Hopkins and others, to mobilize the United States economically to prepare for our obligation to deal with this menace of Hitler and so forth in Europe and in the world in general. We created, from the poor people of our streets, through Harry Hopkins and other Roosevelt programs, we created the greatest economic machine, physical, productive economic machine the world had ever known in our United States. Yes, we had allies that were dependent upon and so forth, but it was the margin of the United States mobilization by Roosevelt which enabled us to defeat Hitler and similar problems. Roosevelt's intention was to get at the root of these global problems by eliminating the power of British imperialism. And that was the big fight between Roosevelt and Churchill all during the war. So what the Roosevelt's intention, as he said clearly, was at the end of the war, as he said to Winston, at the end of the war, Winston, no more British crap. People are going to be freed. There are going to be no more colonies. We're going to use the mighty military war machine, productive machine of the United States to free people, to enable them to develop, to gain their freedom, to eliminate colonies from this planet, and to allow nations to develop to the full dignity of mankind. Now, we didn't do that at the end of the war because Truman was a Churchill lover. He's a bum, too. He was only stuck in because he was a right-winger and Roosevelt was under pressure in 1944. From the right wing, which was resurgent at that point. And they put this character, Truman, in place. And Truman was kissed the butt of Winston Churchill. There's no bones about it. He may kiss some other things too, but the butt was noted. So what Truman did, under the Truman administration, we didn't follow Roosevelt's post-war policy. Roosevelt's post-war policy was to convert the military productive machine which we had generated to win the war, to convert it into a production machine for the benefit of the world, for capital goods and other things for the world. What the Truman administration did was said, no, we like the British. The Truman administration endorsed the recolonization of Indochina. The Japanese soldiers were in prison in Indochina. They had been freed by a revolution which is also supported by the United States, by OSS people and so forth from the United States. Under British orders, the Japanese troops were taken out of the camps, given their weapons again, and told to occupy Indochina. Out of that came the Indochina War, which we spent some time on during the 1960s, 1970s. We did the same thing with the Dutch in Indonesia. We did a modified same thing in India. We did the same thing in Africa. We worked with the British and the Dutch to recolonize the planet, to restore the British Empire, which is what the Anglo-Dutch system is. And what we did in the United States, instead of converting our war machine into production for the world and its development, we shut large parts of it down. We took the war debt we had inherited from the war, but we shut down the means of getting rid of that debt by converting military potential into industrial and related potential. And thus, we, the United States, were on the way down. We've gone down in successive stages. We went down in the first stage under Truman. We went down after the killing of Kennedy. Johnson was terrified. They thought he was going to these three guys are going to shoot him next in the back of the neck or something like that. And he said so. Johnson was not a bad president, he was a terrified president. Then you had the baby boomer factor, in 1968. And that destroyed the United States and let Nixon be elected. And we had that right-wing turn, and we've never recovered from it since. Since 1967, 68, as measured in physical productive output, not money, but physical productive output, the United States has been declining in economic power, physically, per capita, per square kilometer, over every year under every presidency from 1968 to the present time. There has never been a prosperity in the United States. There has been prosperity for some in terms of money, like the thieves back were backing this thing about bailout, but there was not improvement in our infrastructure. We have lost industries. We lost our automobile industry. We have a Japanese industry, which is functioning quite nicely inside the United States. We don't have a U.S. auto industry, and we will never have one. Never as in the normal sense of an auto industry. The Japanese are doing a good job. And similar people are making all the autos we need. But we do need something else. We need the mobilization of the productive power of the United States, which is largely machine tool design and related things, to build our infrastructure, to build systems, to build a railroad system to replace this crazy highway system, to fix our river systems, which are about to collapse, to restore our agriculture, to rebuild manufacturing and similar activities in the United States instead of make work, to rebuild our nation as the American tradition, not the British slavery tradition, which we're operating under now. Now, faced with a period in which under the present system, US dollar is right now essentially worthless. It's not become worthless, but it's becoming worthless, and there's nothing underneath there to stop it from falling. As a matter of fact, the Secretary of the Treasury is causing the dollar to fall at an ever-accelerating rate. We are in hyperinflation. Now, like Weimar in the autumn of 1923, the world is in a hyperinflationary spiral, and it's going to blow out. Now, what do we do? What do we do with a four-power agreement? And Russia is ready to agree to this. Now, forces in Italy and France have declared themselves for it. What they mean by that is still up for some discussion, but it's there. China will support that, but not unless the United States comes in on it, because China is concerned about the price of the dollar. Right? Because China depends largely upon its trade with the United States. India would join it. If Russia joins it, these countries would join it. If this big four, joined quickly by other nations, comes to an agreement, we will put the entire world into bankruptcy reorganization. We will create an intention to form what we would call a new Bretton Woods system. We will use the power of international government, that is not an international agency, but the power of government pulled together as an international force. We will use that force to regulate a fixed currency system throughout the planet. We will put the lid on hyperinflation. We will keep the banks of countries open, the real banks, not the fake ones. We will build the economy by measures of economy building, large-scale needed infrastructure projects, using high technology, using engineering design. This will be a rebuilding of the world economy. We will create new credit, not the fake credit you've been getting lately, but new credit at low interest rates, long-term, just as we did under Roosevelt, to launch the employment in each country under a fixed exchange rate system, which allows us to rapidly build back the productive power of nations. And yes, we are going to take time to clean this mess up that we have today. It'll probably take two generations before we fully eliminate the results of the corruption which has been dumped upon us in the past 40 years. But you have to understand something else. In real terms, in physical economic terms, every policy directive of the United States over the past 40 years has been a miserable failure, a mistake. The U.S. economy, as measured in physical productive powers and output, per capita and per square kilometer, including essential basic economic infrastructure, has been collapsing consistently over 40 years, since the budgetary year of 1967-68. There has been no net growth per capita of real growth in the U.S. economy since that period. What this tells you is that every government of the United States, every session of Congress in the main, and the opinion of newspapers, the leading newspapers and other publications, the opinion of most mass media has been stupid, because we have consistently made the decisions one after the other which made the conditions of life worse with each generation. The per capita physical output of the United States today is less than it was in any preceding period up to going back to 1970, 67, 68. The influence of the baby boomers, the influence of especially the environmentalists, so-called, has been a key factor in this. We have been destroying ourselves. A similar process has gone on in Western Europe. A similar process has gone elsewhere. Now we have a global situation in which there has been an implicit shift of power, a shift of power from Europe and the Americas toward Asia. The future of the planet lies in the development of Russia, China, India, and other Asian countries. These are areas of large populations of which 60 to 70% or more are extremely poor, poorly developed. This represents a social crisis, a planetary social crisis, with all kinds of side effects possible. But if we're going to have a successful planet, we have to concentrate on large-scale infrastructure projects and similar things which will, over two generations, raise the productive powers of labor of populations from all around the world. This means that the major investment in the planet in the period now will become first in Asia. Second, the second largest component will be Black Africa, especially Black Africa. The third component will be development in Central and South America. The United States and Western Europe must be mobilized as a driver, an economic driver, as well as a political driver, to bring about the success of development of the whole planet by what we do in support of the development in South and Central America, in Africa, and in Asia. We need a new mission for mankind. We don't have any enemies in the world who are any worse, any more our enemies than President George Bush is. It is the people who are leading, who are controlling us, and the British, the Anglo-Dutch liberals. These characters are inducing us to destroy ourselves. We don't have real enemies in Asia as nations. We don't have real enemies in South America. We don't have real enemies in Africa, not if we think like Franklin Roosevelt. If we think like Roosevelt, we don't have enemies there. These are our friends, and our government is our enemy. So essentially, what we have, if the American people are able to stand up to this, as many of the people from the lower income brackets, as represented by in the Congress and the House of Representatives, are able to push through the changes that are necessary, I can guarantee you absolutely, if that change is made, Russia will fully cooperate, China will cooperate, India will cooperate, then Japan will cooperate, Korea will cooperate, other nations will cooperate. The nations of Africa will greet this as about being mass murdered now under British policy. They will rejoice in our coming back in the picture in this way. The world will be on the side of the United States. Now, the other thing we have to appreciate is what our United States is. In modern history, there was an evolution coming out of a long period of religious warfare from 1492 to 1648, from the same time as Columbus's first exploration across the Atlantic until the Peace of Westphalia in 1648. Now, during this period, the forces that were trying to crush the nation-state institution were not able to crush the nation-state, because the improvements in productive powers of labor and the increase in intellect and freedom among the rising citizenry within the cities, which were emerging in this period, was such that, as Machiavelli describes this process, the city could defeat the forces of the opposition. And so you had an adaptation by the enemies of humanity called the movement of Paolo Sarpi. And Paolo Sarpi was a slick character, a Venetian, who, among other things, moved the operations of his part of Venice away from the Mediterranean base into northern Europe, centered in Germany, or northern parts of Germany, in the Netherlands, and in England. So the emergence, which was a process which began with the Venetian restructuring of the marriage policies of Henry VIII, which was done from Venice, actually. They sent him a marriage counselor, and he got rid of the wives. He sort of cut off their careers, you know, at the head. Said, you don't need a head anymore. You don't please me. So in any case, so there was a process in which the power of development, of the power of civilization, shifted from the Mediterranean to northern Europe. And the two areas were Netherlands and England. So now there was a split, and the split occurred in 1763, in February 1763, with the Treaty of Paris, the Peace of Paris, in which we in the United States, or what became the United States, broke with England because England had become an empire and was trying to loot us here in what became the United States. Because of this cultural factor, the dominant characteristic of global civilization has been English language leadership and control of global civilization from that time to the present day, especially from 1763 to the present day. Thus, the division between two English-speaking peoples, those of us in the United States today, and those who represented the British oligarchy, the Anglo-Dutch oligarchy, the bankers, the thieves, became the leading force on the planet. Not necessarily the entirely controlling force, but the leading force. And thus, the role of the United States is built into the history of Europe. It's built into the history of civilization like an organic quality, that we in the United States have adopted and have been given the destiny of creating the leadership to assist the rest of the world in becoming free of the British Anglo-Dutch liberal empire and its practices. That was Roosevelt's intention, his explicit intention. That was the intention of every great president we had, every great patriot this country had. We were considered a threat to Britain, to the British Empire, for this reason. Thus, it's built into the cultural relationships within the planet that when the United States takes the moral role, as it did under Roosevelt, and says we are concerned of finding ways of cooperation with other nation states on this planet to form a society of perfectly sovereign nation states which just enters into forms of cooperation in their common interest. We not try to dictate the internal characteristics of the government of these other nations. We simply cooperate with them as national personalities. And we as a national personality cooperate with these other nations as their national personalities and come to common goals and common ends, the common aims of mankind. Now, if we take that policy, not, you know, who's the enemy? Who are we going to beat? I've got one enemy to beat, Anglo-Dutch liberal. The other enemies are simply fools who don't know any better. But we're supposed to know better. We must become again. We must recreate in this country a new political movement based on the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt, based on the legacies which many Republicans bear. A new political movement which adopts the idea of the United States as a unique, universal personality, which has a role to play on this planet for the benefit of humanity as a whole, and therefore for itself. It's the principle of Westphalia, the Peace of Westphalia. The benefit of the other. It's the principle of the modern nation state, the benefit of the other people. Because if you care for the benefit of the other people, you're going to be cared for yourself. You're going to create the kind of society in which you'll be cared for. You create justice for others, you create a climate of justice for yourself. You create a climate of progress, you create a climate of progress for yourself. You know, the experience that I had since I was overseas during World War II and in Asia is to see the evil of the conditions of life and culture under which people live, largely because of the factor of imperialism, of British imperialism in particular, also Dutch imperialism and so forth, all this kind of stuff. And these people then, when I was in India, for example, in the spring of 1945, 46, when I was there, that was the aspiration. The Indians looked to us. Coolies on the street would come up to me in American uniform and said, is the United States going to send us agricultural machinery? Is going to send us textile machinery so we can be no longer coolies at 8 annas a day, but we can have our own life? That was the image of the United States in the eyes of the world as long as Roosevelt was president, and that continued for some time. Roosevelt represented the best tradition of the United States, not trying to find out who's the enemy to beat. An enemy is someone who's coming out to kill you. Well, you'd fight them off. But you're not looking for a system of relations among states based on adversarial considerations. Your system, while it may deal with adversarial problems, must, in the long run, rely upon non-adversarial issues like that of the Peace of Westphalia. Under those conditions, given how terrible the situation is right now with our monetary financial system, if we, the United States, if we can force in this United States to take this piece of crap, this president, and force this presidency to move, to make an agreement. It doesn't require a full-fledged, worked-out agreement. It requires a process of getting to an agreement to come to an agreement among Russia, the United States, China, India, and other countries, which now probably include Italy and France and some others. Under those conditions, we, as a combination of powers, can dictate what the fixed exchange rate of the monetary system will be. We can dictate and regulate against inflation. We can create credit and large-scale creation of new technologies, new signs of infrastructure. We can do these things, but we have to agree to agree. Then apply the power represented by that agreement among these powers and others who join them to crush that force which is imposing this hyperinflation upon the entire world, and is now threatening to use even U.S. troops to try to suppress anybody who opposes a bailout which would in itself destroy the United States. These guys behind the Secretary of Treasury don't care about the United States. They care about their class, their Wall Street class, their investment banking class. They care more about Goldman Sachs than they do the United States. and they want revenge against the United States for allowing Goldman Sachs to go bankrupt. Or it is bankrupt, actually. So that's the issue. Now there's the positive side has another aspect. There is a certain idiocy about economics, not only among our economists. Well, generally, I mean, if you want to become an idiot in economics, you have to study economics and become professional at it. You cannot be a successful idiot without becoming professional. And most, there are good economists in the sense that they do things which are useful, they know things which are important. But when it comes to the basic questions of international systems, we don't have economists who call economists who know what the hell the score is. Just don't know it. They may be well-meaning people, they're often intelligent people. They know something. They are useful at something. But they don't understand the basics of economics because they believe what they're taught in universities. And that's the first way, that's the first step down to the absolute destruction of your intellect these days. The point is very simple. The idiot says that, exactly the free trader, I don't know who he's trading in, but it's a free trader, says, well, everything starts from the point of production. Well, that's nonsense. Not successful economy does not start from the point of production. For example, let's take a case in about 1910, 1912. In the area of New York City in general, because Edison was in that area, and there was a development and improvement in electrical motors, the small electrical motors, which could be attached to individual machines. And there was a leap in productivity in the greater New York area through the Edison method of introducing these individual machines of these new types to attach them to machines rather than belt-driven systems or similar kinds of systems. It was a leap in productivity. There was no significant increase as such to account for this increase in productivity at the point of production otherwise. But it was the effect of changing the environment of production. This is only an expression of something else which happens in economics. It is fundamental discoveries of physical principle which are the source of the increase of productive powers of labor. Therefore, and the adoption of a discovered principle and the perfection of the implementation of the application of that principle is something which is not localized to something. Yes, one individual mind may have made this discovery, or groups of individual minds may have made the discovery, but it's the application of these discoveries to whole areas of the society's production, or its living. Like a good mass transit system, instead of driving on the highway and losing, $7 and going from West Virginia to here in the Washington area, and then spending 3.5 hours and so forth commuting each way on a traffic area, which means what? A loss of personal family life. Take 6 hours out of each person's life, or 5 hours each life a day for this. What have you done to the family life? What have you done in a system where it takes two adult members of a household to supply the income to raise any kind of family in a halfway decent way? You are destroying the family. You're creating all the kinds of problems you wish to have in the family. You're probably creating the problems in the community, because you are saying the time that people have to spend wasting going through this kind of nonsense is not important. That's only personal life. It doesn't affect the economy. We're only concerned with how much work they do. So they travel, they work 8 hours a day, and 3 or 4 hours of those days, or five, are spent in commuting with fares and so forth. And when both members of the family are stuck in a situation like that, what kind of family life do you have? What kind of intellectual and emotional life do you have in your children? What's the school education like? So that the biggest factors in productivity are not necessarily point of production measures, like this sort of thing. The biggest thing are discoveries of universal principles and changes in the organization of society, which can take a person with the same level of productivity and make them more productive by changing the circumstances under which they work, including the technology which is applied to them. So the way in which we must operate is directly opposite to what's done under greedy influence. For take another case, the question of power. What is the nature of progress in power? Well, power is not measured in calories. You can measure heat and you measure it in calories all you want to, but that does not measure power. Power is measured in energy flux density. This is basic principle of nuclear physics. To get to a certain state, you must have a corresponding level of energy flux density, or you cannot get into that, enter that state. Therefore, to make certain kinds of production, you have to go to a higher energy flux density. So it is not that having low temperature energy sources is not a substitute for high temperature resources. Typical. Education, which orients people to physical science and to classical culture, produces a more productive mind from the same person or the same population as one who doesn't have that kind of education. A person who goes to rock concert is less intelligent than a person who doesn't. It's true. They got rocks in their head. It's hard to hear anything. So therefore, what we fail to realize is it's not infrastructure in the broad sense of the term. It's a certain kind of infrastructure. It's efficient mass transit systems. It's the way we organize cities, as opposed to these super cities or super areas, in which people have to go 5 hours of commuting a day to and from work, which destroys them. It's the better organization of society, a better transportation system, more available high temperature facilities, or take the case of fuel. What an idiot is to haul petroleum from Saudi Arabia to the United States to run our cars. They're nuts. With a high-temperature gas-cooled reactor of the Jülich type, the pebble bed type of reactor, we can rather easily generate synthetic fuels from water. The synthetic fuels are essentially hydrogen-based fuels. Now, if we have large-scale reactors of that type in various areas of the country, one of the byproducts of this system of reactors in that part of the country is to produce hydrogen-based fuels. Now you change the whole structure of your fuel economy from an oil petroleum economy, and now you shift it around so you now have hydrogen-based fuel applications, you have domestic systems of heating, all these kinds of things. Suddenly, everything is cheaper and better. And so what is not understood, what is not respected, is the fact that productivity is not how hard you work at the point of production or how much skill you have at the point of production. Those things can be significant, especially skill. But the important thing is the total environment, transportation systems, power systems, all these things that define the environment. This is a simple issue which on the one side separated Leibniz from Descartes. Economics is taught in most parts of the world today based on a Cartesian conception. Whereas science, real science, is taught on the basis of a Leibnizian conception, which is called dynamics. And the important thing is how you control the dynamics. Now, what we can do, therefore, internationally, is by applying the highest technology, the highest degree of technology we have or can develop, and applying that on the broadest possible scale through infrastructure as well as education. Through that, we create the environment which we can take people who are Chinese, of the 70% who are very poor productivity, or India, the 70% very poor productivity. We can take, and by creating a different kind of environment of technology and systems, we can increase the productive powers of that labor even before they're able to develop higher degrees of skill and knowledge otherwise. And that's our job. In nations which have this kind of science-driven culture among us and related culture, must mobilize ourselves away from this whole green environmentalist nonsense. It's all a lie. It's all a fraud. And get back to real science and have science drive programs which we in countries which have a higher degree of development can do, and do use our brains and our ability to supply this kind of technology, technological improvement, to the poorest parts of the world. For example, Africa. Africa, black Africa, has the largest agricultural region of the world. But they don't get much to eat. Why? The bugs and everything else kills off the food. They don't have all the protection systems they need. They don't have a distribution system that protects them. So what do? We move in, we say, well, we're going to put in this international railway magnetic system, levitation system. So we're going to drive an international rail system or magnet system into Africa. We're going to create, as a gift from the other nations of the world, we're going to give them as a gift a railway or maglev system, which is the basic system, which means that in these countries they have the basic means to transport goods from one place to the other. That and also power systems and so forth delivered to them will enable them to do the rest. And that's the point. The way you develop a people is not by coming in and telling them how to do everything. You give them the things which will enable them to do something for themselves, and you help them do it. In short, to conclude this presentation before we get to the questioning and discussion, any good solution for a problem of the magnitude we face today, we're facing a new dark age for all humanity, not somewhere down the line, we're facing it before Christmas time. Your neighbor may be hanging from your Christmas tree. You find that kind of situation. In this kind of situation, there's only one remedy. And that remedy is love of mankind. And you're saying, how can we fix this problem? Not how to make somebody rich, how to give them what they want, but how we can help them achieve the betterment of their selves and create a betterment of relations among states. And then invoke the fact that we're doing that to induce nations to come to agreements, firm agreements, which change the character of relations on this planet in the way that we should see we need when we look at the Plano option in Mexico, when we look at other projects in South America that are there, when we look at the great needs of Africa, which are a mass starvation area of the world, we look at the large parts of populations of Asia, 70% are miserable existence, with no future, brutalized. We have the power to change that if we mobilize. We can make the commitment to that change as a policy to bring nations together on that basis. Russia is ready to do that if the United States will accept it. That we've determined, that's clear. Italy is determined to move in that direction with the new Bretton Woods. Sarkozy of France is determined to lead from France in the same objective. China will cooperate if they're sure the United States will cooperate. India will cooperate. Other nations will cooperate. We all need this. The alternatives are not getting it is hell. So you can't complain about the prices. We need it. And we have to have a shift from this hate attitude. Who to hate? Who to kill? Who to make a war against? They shouldn't have fired Musharraf. The United States did it as a favor to the Saudis to fire that. Look at the chaos we're getting in Pakistan now as a result of that. We have to have a policy of conflict, not of conflict, but of love. It has to be concrete. And on that basis, you can bring nations together. They will trust each other on that basis. If you don't do that, they won't trust you. You can't do a damn thing. That's your problem. So it's on the table. What I proposed last year, last July, on the 25th, is the only damn good idea on this planet regarding this problem to date. Now, either you've got the guts to accept that, or you're going to go to hell. I'm not going to send you there. You're going to send yourself. And therefore, we need to end this bill, destroy it, put the whole thing into bankruptcy reorganization, under which what we need to have functioning will function. The essential part of banks, as defined by earlier legislation, we'll protect those parts of the bank, whether they're bankrupt or not, because the communities need them. They need their savings protected. They need them. We'll protect them. The government will protect them. We'll deal with the other people's claims later on when we get around to it. Well, why should we have to pay off a gambler who lost? Is a gambler's dictatorship? Why should we have a fool like this stuck in Secretary of Treasury? With his background, with his record, it's almost as bad as Alan Greenspan. Why should we listen to these fools? Why should we put these thieves and fools in power? Can't we trust ourselves if we have good intentions? I trust the American people. I trust those people out there who are enraged. I don't trust them to do the right thing, but I trust their rage. They are justly enraged. This government, this country has betrayed them. The Congress has betrayed them. Now, specifically this, the problem lies largely in the Senate, as you may see today on the vote, because this thing is going to go back and forth. And the danger is that somebody in the White House is going to think about calling the troops out to suppress the population if they don't like the vote they think they're going to get on the second vote in the House of Representatives. And people have to understand that. You've got fascism in this country right now. And the center of fascism is right in the White House. Don't kid yourself about it. Now, the White House occupant is an idiot, an immoral, vicious idiot. But nonetheless, the power has been in his hands. And fools will let him have it and let him use it. Or Paulson and his crowd will enforce it. You can have dictatorship here. Remember, the grandfather of the present president of the United States was the guy who wrote the order to bail Adolf Hitler out when his party was bankrupt near the end of 1932. This crowd were Nazis. The grandfather of the present president of the United States was a Nazi. His father of the present president was in that direction. He's called a silly kind of Nazi, but silly, but vicious. That power is there. And only if the American people make it clear, they will not tolerate that. And I tell you, there are many people in the Senate who are gutless on this question. They want to survive. They're too much concerned with their survival to be concerned with the survival of the nation or humanity in general. And they have to learn that sometimes when you try to preserve your life, you lose it exactly that way.
Thank you, Lynn. Well, it's good to know that somebody knows what to do. Before I get to the questions, let me just mention a special note that I'd like to welcome some of the audiences that are gathered around the world today. We have audiences in Africa. We have a significant gathering in Barcelona. There is a very large audience gathered in the Mexican Congress, and they are joined by Quincy O'Neill, who is the vice chairman of the Afro-American Caucus of the California State Democratic Party, and he is currently visiting Mexico along with other members of the LaRouche Youth Movement, and they are quite excited about the response that they are getting there. We also know that the webcast is being broadcast live in at least 5 universities in Colombia's capital, in Bogota. And there really are an unknown number in other cities. I can only judge really by the volume of questions that are coming in. And certainly I want to welcome all those who are listening, and I hope that in the course of our discussion that all of your questions will be answered, even if they're not read directly. A good number of the questions really are in the same vein. As always, I'm going to begin with some institutional questions from here in Washington. I will mix in institutional questions from around the world. I will take questions from those of you who are gathered here in the audience. As always, I will ask you to fill out an index card with your name, your affiliation, and the nature of your question. If you would like me to read it, please write out your question. If you wish to ask it, indicate that. But again, you must let me know what it is you wish to ask so that we have some sense of organization to the day's activities. Lynn, the first question comes from someone who I think you will recognize. And he says, Mr. LaRouche, as I'm sure you know, people like former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, and others among us have been engaged in international discussions for a new financial architecture precisely along the lines of what you have proposed. And while there is obviously far more of an appetite for this now than ever before, at the same time, they all insist that this bailout must come first in order to give leaders time to act. Clearly, you disagree with this, but I still would appreciate your comments.
If you go with a bailout, you're going to destroy the United States in short order through hyperinflation. The bailout is intrinsically hyperinflationary. The only reason that anybody in their right mind would even think of supporting this bill is because they're scared. And we need a Gideon's army to pull through the reform. And some of you who are biblical scholars, you know what I'm talking about. You have to take all the people who are cowards, who will not step up to the plate, as they say, on this issue, and say, okay, dear coward, we're taking over. We're leading. Now, the danger here, of course, is that you're going to have a French Revolution problem, as I said, inside the United States. You now have, and some of these idiots, and even my friendly friends out there, who say, please, please be cautious, let this bill go through so they won't shoot us. That's what they're saying. They're saying that behind the Bush administration, there are people who would actually use U.S. troops to shoot down people who want to oppose this bill. That's there right now. That is reality. And that's what some of these questions are reflecting. There are people in high places, including some very high-ranking people in terms of their background, who agree totally with what I say about this stuff, but they won't fight because they say, we'll be shot. We don't want to go into a death camp. Well, if we go into a death camp because we do this, the world will never forgive those who do it. And the world will never forgive those who capitulate to this. Anybody who's smart is not going to take on the American people in that fashion. You're not going to shove a dictatorship down the throat of the American people. They'll kill you. They'll kill you. And they can. Learn the lesson of Vietnam and a few other locations. They will kill you, and they can, if you make them angry enough. And you're about to make them very angry. The reason you're getting such a peculiar behavior in the House of Representatives' background is because the people out there were behind the people who voted against this bill. Those people out there are ready to kill. Not because they're killers, but because they see the destruction of everything that life means to them is threatening them. They've seen a lot of it, step by step. They put up with it. They've accepted it. They've crawled for it. He said, we have to get along, we have to get along. The time has come when they know that everything is being taken away from them, and that was too much. You're going to find the rage against the White House and against the Senate in particular is going to escalate in ways during the coming days of this week and next week, in ways beyond anything most of you believe. I can see it right there. It's there. It's coming. The mood in the American people, having gone through fake wars, they've had their children sent out into fake wars like Iraq. It was a fake war. We don't need to go there. No need to get into that war. And they got into it, they made a mess of it, even what they started. No need. Look at the suffering of people who were in service, come back from that war, not only with death, but injuries, but they can't get help. They're condemned to horrible conditions. And in every neighborhood in the United States, there's someone in that category. It radiates. Don't you see the hatred you're building up against Washington in the people of the United States? And this bill is one bill too many. You're headed for something like a French Revolution, and you're going to bring it on your own heads if you're dumb enough not to fight this bill and not to oppose it. There is no remedy. There is no excuse for supporting this bill. None. There is no moral excuse for opposing this bill.
Okay, the next question, again, from someone who Lynn will understand, will recognize. Mr. LaRouche, I know firsthand that you're quite right that the Russians do favor talks that would include the United States, among others, to begin to craft a new financial architecture. But the fact is that this current administration is in no way inclined to do so, and have rejected the proposal when it was put to them, both by the Russians and also by people inside the United States. My question to you is this. Even with some institutional support here in America, I'm not sure I understand how this could work without the agreement of the U.S. presidency. I think that you have some idea how, in fact, it could, and I'd like you to go through that for us.
Well, because my dear questioner, who I like very much, admire very much for what he does and so forth, doesn't think quite as I do. Because, you know, there are many people in this country who communicate with me, but the same people don't talk to me. They communicate to intermediaries. And someone who's afraid to talk to me has got a weakness, a political weakness, for dealing with a crisis of this sort. I can assure you, I know about the opposition in France, the resistance, but I also know about the other side. And I know that the principle in politics, as my questioner knows, real politics is based on the burned tail principle. So what you have to look at is you don't have to look. Don't look at what somebody says they'll go for. Who's going to burn that tail, and how hot is it going to get? That's the way politics works. It happened in a sense in Italy, because what's proposed in the Italian Parliament, and with a growing circle in Italy, is precisely a proposal by name of my Bretton Woods proposal. Russia will go for it now. The other side of the thing is the tail-burning problem, which is not just popular opinion. If anybody goes with this bill, there's not going to be a United States. If Europe goes, there's not going to be a Europe. If you vote for this bill, you're not going to have a United States much longer. The hyperinflation that's going to hit you is going to destroy it. So if you believe in the United States, you're against the bill. because the worst option is to lose the United States and lose civilization. Therefore, there is no threat, there is no problem so great, if you're a commander in war, or a commander in a situation like war, as I'm speaking now, you do what you must do for the present and future of humanity. You don't make excuses for not doing it. You may try to do it better, you try to do it smarter, you try not to be stupid and make stupid mistakes, but you do it. We must not let this line be crossed. If this line is crossed, if the bill is put into effect, the United States will cease to exist as a result of that decision. I am not prepared to make that decision, nor am I prepared to make excuses for anybody who will make that decision. If you believe in the United States, you're going to get rid of the bill. If you're not going to get rid of the bill, you're not a real patriot. You're a sunshine patriot.
Now, back in the day when the press used to refer to Lynn as political extremist Lyndon LaRouche, we used to joke that his mother was probably very confused by this, saying, "I did not name my son political extremist." After Lynn's remarks, I think my parents probably say, "I did not name my daughter intermediary." Lynn, the next question is from a member of the United States Senate, a Democratic member of the Senate, who has to decide how he's going to vote this evening. And he says, "Mr. LaRouche, in trying to decide how I would vote tonight, I asked my friend Joe Stieglitz what he recommended. His response was odd. He said to me that there were a variety of reasons why the Paulson plan would not and could not work, including the fact that over the last 48 hours, the $700 billion price tag attached to it is probably closer to $1.3 trillion and is growing. Nevertheless, Dr. Stieglitz recommended that I should vote yes. He said that it was essentially a very expensive way to buy the time needed for us to reorganize and re-regulate. Clearly, you disagree, but I'm really at a loss as to how to proceed. If, in fact, this measure passes, is it true that we pass a point of no return?"
Well, you pass morally the point of no return. When you could defeat the enemy, and you say not to defeat them because you would rather do it more comfortably, then you have given in to the enemy, and the enemy takes charge, and you've lost the power to resist. You had a point of no return. You win the battle now or you lose it. You have no choice. Again, some are patriot, sunshine patriot, trying to say, "Isn't there some way?" Well, that's why I'm a leader, and that's why some of these guys aren't leaders. They may be elected to high office, but they're not leaders. Because when the nation is in danger, a leader is someone who leads the nation to safety and is willing to do what is necessary to defend the nation from the consequences of not doing it. I'm a leader. Other people are quasi-leaders. They're useful people, but they need a tougher leader than they are to handle the situation. And they need to listen to someone who's tougher than they are to deal with this kind of situation. This is a situation of command. It's like command in warfare, in general warfare. Have you got the guts to do it, or are you going to make excuses? This is what Lincoln's problem was, Lincoln's general's problem was. That's why he was shipping whiskey to Grant, to find a general that could fight. So that's the brave answer. This is a question of leadership. I am showing leadership. Are you willing to do so? I need more people who will show leadership. I need commanders, not apologists, not wimps. Isn't there a safer way to do this? No, there's not a safer way to do it. You're taking on the enemies of humanity. What do you think it is, a pussycat fight? This is the time you get serious. This is the time you put your life on the line for the sake of your nation and civilization.
Lynn, this is another question from a Democratic member of the Senate. Mr. LaRouche, when FDR moved to address the banking crisis in the 1930s, he made no bones about the fact that building our way out of the Great Depression would carry with it hardship and that it would be hard on the population. Right now, I am inclined to vote against the bailout. But I also don't want to lie to my constituents and tell them that I have a painless solution, especially if we do not. My question to you is, what, in your assessment, is the pain threshold of your proposal?
The pain threshold of my proposal, if you don't support it, you're dead. It's that simple. That's a question of leadership. I mean, you could take a lot of people and you say, okay, this guy may be a good corporal, but we don't got to make a commanding general out of him because he's going to lose the war. Roosevelt never lost the war. There's two things involved here. You don't get into foolish fights if you don't have to. But you don't use the rule of not getting into foolish fights not to fight when you have to. The time comes when you decide you're going to fight. You don't start fights. The enemy started the fight. We're trying to defend the United States against the enemy, which happens to include the United States president. He's not the enemy in the sense of a foreign foe. He's the enemy in terms of his idiocy. He is itself an enemy of the United States. His father's foolishness and his own idiocy. Maybe his father helped create the idiocy. I'm concerned that there are people in this country, including many people who are poor people, the poor people who are burning the tails of the members of the House of Representatives. They're fighting. They're not rich. They're poor. They don't have much, and that's being taken away from them, even food. Then you have people in our institutions, some of them former military leaders, other positions, or associations, which they had in the past, which they cling to still as their tradition, which they fight for. We have people in this country who will fight and defend this nation, but we don't have a concentration of that kind of leadership in our political class. Because carefully, look, I deal with politicians, and the politicians know this. They'll even admit it to me in a private discussion. They are sophists. This culture is sophist. The more you associate with people in the so-called higher social ranks of society, the worse the sophistry is. Look at the guy on Wall Street. Is that schnook human? Does he have human values? Is his life organized around human values? Is he doing something for society? He's having a frantic fit. A sexual fit on the floor of the exchange over whether he's going to get an orgasm that day or not. By the financial orgasm in this case. Is this guy going to fight for the country? Is he willing to give up something for the nation, for future generations? No. I want my money. I need it. Well, who needs that amount of money that these golden parachutes represent? Who needs that kind of money? What for? What are you going to give it to the poor? You're going to build something, a factory, that you're against? The problem is we do have people in this country who have guts. But we are a society which is basing government on the will of the people, the consent of the people. And therefore, we depend largely upon the consent of the people. And often, this becomes the consent of the poor people. Because not only because they're the most numerous, because they have the most to lose and the least to gain. And therefore, poorer people tend to be more courageous than people with more money. This is a prime principle of Christian doctrine, by the way, through the gate, the camel through the gate, the eye of the camel. And it's the poor who have nothing to gain or lose but accept life and the purpose of life itself, and who think not of themselves as much but of children. Let me just interpolate something which is very significant here, which I mentioned recently repeatedly. One of the characteristics of the baby boomer generation is that you think back to my experience, for example, which is fairly relevant these days, since there's a shortage of people my age. We'd be much better off if we had more people my age. Unfortunately, they went away, didn't stay with me, and so on. But that we used to have a sense of value, which is based on several generations. We think of the immigrant families who came in from poor immigrants who came in from Europe into the United States, for example. They would come in and they would end up, you know, in the immigration process proceedings, and often they didn't, their skills were limited. Even if they had skills, they had trouble getting their skills, professional skills, qualified inside the United States for use. So they would work, and are there people in this room who are grandchildren of just exactly these types of people? And they would work, and they would almost slave to make a life which is better for their children's generation. And they would look forward with great joy to what their grandchildren might become. And you would often have people came off the boat as really hand labor, and their grandchildren were physicians, scientists, and so forth in this country. That was the nature of the country. And what has happened now, we have lost that sense, especially in the white-collar baby boomer influence generation. People think about themselves as a self-contained entity. They don't think of their life as having a purpose which reaches beyond their demise. They don't realize that the meaning of their life lies not in what they experience as such directly, but what comes out of it. What they can be confident will come out of it. And the people who think that way, which ordinary poor people tend to think that way, will fight for the life of their grandchildren, whereas the baby boomer will not. And I have a lot of dealing with children of baby boomers, as you may know. And I know what their existential complaint is. Their parents' generation does not have a commitment to the future generations. They say, oh, we had a child. Oh, what a nice little toy to play with. Then the toy, I don't like that toy anymore. Throw it away. I got a new wife. I got a new husband. I got a new nothing. I got to change my life. I don't like that toy anymore. There's no purpose in life. And what we've bred is we've bred generations which lack a purpose in life. And a purpose in life extends beyond your own life. It extends to respect for what came before you. You try to think back as far back, and generally you can think back to your grandparents' generation. But some of us, we think, like me, we think much longer. You think back to more ancient parts of your family and the experience of people of that generation. And you think about what was the commitment that they made on which you prosper, or which your society today prospers. And you understand that. And you look at your life in that way as if you were going to die. And you look what's coming out of your life for your children, your grandchildren, and that those generations coming ahead. Are you building for the future? The father used to take the child by the hand, or the grandfather, and take him to a great work, which is accomplished by mankind, and say, I built that. I was part of building that. And that's for you. That's the American. But we have many people among the baby boomer generation who've lost that sense of identity. They've lost the sense of immortality, and their religious beliefs show it.
For those of you who are listening via the internet, you are listening to a live broadcast from Washington, D.C., addressed by Lyndon LaRouche. Lynn, I should mention that among the dozens and dozens of messages that are coming in as we speak, virtually everyone begins the same way, by declaring how proud people are that you're an American and thanking you for what you're doing. And before I ask the next question, I'd like to just take a moment and once again thank Lynn for this presentation and for his efforts on behalf of all those people, because I don't intend to read all their messages. Okay, so the next question, Lynn, has been submitted by 17 freshman members of the House of Representatives. And they say, Mr. LaRouche, most of us were elected on the basis of ending the war in Iraq. Few of us pretended to be experts in global finance. We've been up here for a while, and clearly we've not succeeded in ending the war, which was something that we did know about. And now we're being asked to act on a far more complex problem that few of us truly understand. Taking direction from you, we've studied the period from 1932 on, and we've examined FDR's approach to ending the Depression. And while we concede that the system today is far more complex than it was then, it does nevertheless seem that the overall approach that he took would work. In fact, while it wouldn't necessarily be easy to do, it seems simple enough in approach, if that makes any sense. So then, with all of that said, and with your proposals on the table, with the insistence that we really have reached the end of the rope, why is there so much opposition to an FDR solution?
Let's take two characters of influence who are not the story as a whole, but who typify the story, exemplify what the problem is. You have two pigs, one called Felix Rohatyn, and this man is a fascist pig. I mean, he really is. There's no exaggeration at all. That's the kindest thing you could say about him. Otherwise, the pigs might object. But the point, then you have George Soros. And look at George Soros' character. Look at what he admits his character to be. Look what his father described his character to be. George Soros, as a teenager, worked for the Nazis in the process which was called the extermination. 500 people of Jewish designation were butchered by the Nazis, but they were collected either from Hungary or collected there from Romania and other states. They were then shipped in packets. There's a book was written by a famous author, Ben Hecht, called Perfidy, that Hitler and the Hitler administration had made a proffer to allies that if they would ship so many trucks, that so many Jews would not be executed. So for this purpose, the Nazis collected Jews from Romania and so forth, as well as in Hungary itself. And often these were questionable Jews because they had not thought of themselves as being Jewish, they had Jewish ancestry, and from mixed marriages and so forth. And so anything that had the possible label of a Jewish ancestor would be picked up from this area and processed. Now, what happened is that George Soros's father, who told the story of how this happened, got his son put under the protection of someone's family to hide his Jewish identity. And the son ran errands in the extermination process. So every time that Hitler didn't get these trucks, as Ben Hecht describes the story, then more Jews was put on the train and shipped up to the extermination camps. And he was the one who delivered the notices, among his other duties. That's not the worst of it, because under those kinds of conditions, people do all kinds of things, particularly weak and frightened people. But the point is to the most recent record, he's proud of it. Not that he's proud they got these Jews killed, he doesn't say that, but he's proud of what he did. He's proud of his experience. He called this experience character building. Now, if we look at his character as what he does, as a drug pusher, what is George Soros? George Soros is a British agent. He's an agent of the British Foreign Office, a subsidiary division, the Commonwealth division. He is known, best known, became best known, when in the formation of what became known as the Maastricht Agreement, when that pig, Margaret Thatcher, and her lover, in a sense, political lover, George Bush, H.W. Bush, sold out Europe by breaking up the Rate Commission, European Rate Commission, in which they sank the British pound artificially for a period of time in order to break the Rate Commission, and thus they were able to introduce the Maastricht conditions and enforce them, which was the destruction of Europe. Soros is evil. We know him from South Asia operations. He was liked by Al Gore, which tells you he's evil. Anything Al Gore likes has to be bad. Al Gore had a fit, went out there in a disgusting, undiplomatic. Al Gore's a real degenerate. Anyway, so that, and then he is a big drug pusher. He operates out of the Caribbean, largely, but he still does operations. He was a controller of Gorbachev at some point, still an influence on Gorbachev. He ran the operation in Georgia, for example, operations all over the world. He's a drug runner. He's involved big in drug running, operating out of the Caribbean. And this guy, with his ill-gotten, filthy gains, controls the Democratic Party. He's not an American. He's a Brit. He's a British Foreign Office asset. He controls the Democratic Party. He's a pig.
Rotten is of a similar type. Different pedigree, but similar behavior. Rotten is famous for what he did in Argentina with Pinochet, which was a genocide operation run partly by Nazis who were brought into South America in the Southern Cone for a genocide operation.
And that's what he was tied up into, and he knew it. Of course, George Shultz was his boss, which explains some of the things that are going on now. George Shultz is a killer. And these are the kinds of people who do evil. But that's what the problem is. And how does this run? Well, they control our press. If you look at the records of the Democratic and Republican presidential campaigns, in this campaign, how much was controlled by Soros? How much was Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, is controlled by Rohatyn. The Republican Party, Soros. The majority of the presidential campaigns and related campaigns in this year have been controlled by British money or institutions of British money. We're controlled by the British Empire. What was the reason that the Prime Minister of England or Britain came here to visit? To get some of that bailout money, over $300,000 of that bailout money for $1 billion, the bailout money for the British, to bail out the British. We are suckers for the British. We have all these agents who don't represent the United States who are actually our enemies, who are doing this to us. And we sit back, oh, they're respectable. We're disgusting, isn't it? How can we degrade ourselves to submit ourselves to this?
Hey, Lynn, this is a question from a Democratic member of the House of Representatives who voted no on the bailout package. Mr. LaRouche, some of us who voted no on the bailout package are now being told that everything we demand can and will be taken up, but that it cannot be done until we pass the Paulson plan and stabilize the banks. Do this, we are being told, and all other things. Hillary Clinton's mortgage proposal, an HFC, a PCORA commission, full re-regulation, all are possible. Now, I wasn't born yesterday, but it does seem that they're willing to deal on these matters. However, if I understand correctly, you're saying that if we do this, we will unleash unstoppable inflation. However, what some people are telling us is that that hyperinflation has already been unleashed. I'm not really sure what's going to happen over the next couple of days, but really what I'm asking you, because I think that we may not be able to stop this bailout package from going through, even though I still intend to vote no. My question to you, though, is if we can't stop it, then what do we do next?
Pray. I think our job is to stop it. I don't think God takes sympathy on, expresses sympathy for people who won't fight. That's what you're here for. You're here to do a job. If you're not going to do the job, no pension. I think that's, isn't that the rule of the game? No, we make the decision. You know, they will not keep any of the promises. They'll promise you anything but give you our page. They promise anything. His job is to get you to go along, for fear of this, a little bit of intimidation, a little bit of promise. I love you, buddy. I'm going to kill you today, but tomorrow I'll love you. This is like the guy who comes home, you know, after being with his five of his mistresses and telling his wife, oh, I love you. That's what these guys are like. No, it's a fraud. If this is passed, there will be no United States to deliver anything. And you, in the meantime, if you allow it to happen, will not be able to do anything about it. And you will go to this guy and say, but you promised. He said, I'm sorry, I lied. But you have to understand, I had to. I was ordered to. It's a key problem. You have people in the lower income brackets who are typified by the constituency of the House of Representatives. They have indicated clearly that the heat on their tail is terrific. It's hot, very hot. And therefore, the members of the House of Representatives have a force behind them, ordinary people. The Senate tends to think it's abstracted from this situation and can operate at a distance. Well, we'll get around to it later. Well, you won't be in the Senate, buddy. You'll probably be in a concentration camp. And you will say to the guy who's registering you in the concentration camp, yeah, but I voted for the bill. So what, sucker?
Lynn, this next question is a long and detailed one, but it encompasses a whole slew of other questions like it. So I'm going to read it to you, and you can figure out what you want to answer here, and then I'll also give you the written text so that you can take it up later. This is from a staffer to a Democratic member of the House. He says, Mr. LaRouche, as a staffer to a Democratic member of the House, I've been trying to present your alternatives to my boss for months, and above all now, in the context of this awful bailout bill. He's open, but I've not been able to find enough detail to successfully counter the kinds of objections people throw back at me. Particularly, I've tried to present your alternative of a two-tiered credit system and fixed exchange rates. Specifically, can you help me with the following, most of which are taken from your July 22nd webcast? Number one, you said on July 22nd that we needed to increase the discount rate from 2% to 4% in order to, quote, prevent an outflow of financial capital from the U.S. banking system. You go on to repeat several times that the problem is that with a Fed rate at 2%, it causes capital to leave the banks as loans, but at 4%, the capital stays as a lendable asset that you then make loans against. I can't make sense of what you mean, that the present 2% rates cause money to leave the banks. There's no empirical evidence I can find that bank deposits are leaving. Are you saying 2% causes a run on the banks? And if so, why would 4% change this? Aren't bank runs caused when people fear that the banks will go under and aren't insured? Two, also in the same discussion, you keep talking about keeping money in the U.S. Every day we run a current account deficit, so money is always coming in. I can't find any evidence of a problem keeping money in the U.S., at least not yet. So I need you to explain to me what you mean. Three, you also say that the banks have credit in the form of deposits against which they can issue loans, which you also refer to as assets. But as I learned it, bank deposits are liabilities, not credits or assets. Again, I need clarification. And finally, while in principle fixed exchange rates sound right, you don't address how that could work if speculators attack a currency. A fixed rate would cause central banks to pour potentially unlimited amounts of money to defend the currency and eventually lose it all for nothing. And I'm not sure how we could prevent those kinds of speculative attacks. Thank you very much for all your help on this. The present crisis has certainly confirmed everything you've been saying, and I'm really anxious to try to move this through Congress.
Well, first of all, the key thing we have to understand is that what people believe about money is wrong, because we're in a society in which the miseducation is tremendous. But it's not only a question of what they believe about money, it's about what is adopted as policies about money. The Roosevelt-Bretton Woods system, which is consistent with the intention of our Constitution, though there have been fights over this throughout the history of the United States, since the Treasury Secretary, first set Treasury Secretary of the United States. The United States system is not a monetary system. So throw monetary theory out the window. We are not a monetary system. We are a credit system. Read your Constitution and catch on to what some of the theories. Figure out what a pig Jefferson was, for example, in putting through his banking reform against the Treasury. Yeah, there are a lot of swindles out there. But what is the intent of our Constitution, and what is the essence of the American system as opposed to the damn brutish system? We are a credit system, not a monetary system. That is, our money is created by authorization of an act of Congress, which gives the presidency the power to utter money as credit in either the form of money, printed money, or in the form of credits transmitted through the federal banking system down to local banks, in which authorized characteristics of expenditure, authorized by the Congress or authorized implicitly by the Congress, are then funded through placing credit, federal credit, in the hand, which is federal debt, in the hands of a bank or in the hands of a firm. Sometimes we then convert that directly into money, but along the line, somewhere this thing will authorize a utterance of money to correspond to the credit created. Now, the European systems are not American systems. They are monetary systems, not credit systems. And this is laid out, for example, by Henry Carey and others in their own terms. But the principle is already there. The principle is we are not a monetary system. What happened is that what Roosevelt defined as the Bretton Woods system in 1944 at the Bretton Woods Conference, the same conference that Keynes was there, was a credit system, not a monetary system. What happened after Roosevelt's death is Truman and Company converted the international system, fixed exchange rate system, into a monetary system, a British system. Now, a British system, a monetary system, is based on an old Venetian type of principle in which money is uttered in various ways by various kinds of institutions, but not under the control of government. Government may regulate this, government may intervene with it, but the essence of money is not federal, it's not credit. So therefore, in the British system, money or money systems become an independent force dealing and negotiating with the credit systems of the nation, that credit system in the sense of constitutional or quasi-constitutional systems. So therefore, the utterance of money is out of the control, essentially, of government in one way or the other. What is practiced is, and this is a characteristic of the Anglo-Dutch liberal system. The Anglo-Dutch liberal system is the essence of the British Empire. This is the Sarpi system, Paolo Sarpi. This is the northern system. This is the real British Empire. When you get to, in economics and financial matters, the collision you get between the two systems on the one hand is the American system, which is a credit system. That's the system of freedom, the system of political government. The other side is the British system, or the Anglo-Dutch liberal system, which is based on money. It's based on central banking. We are not a central banking system, though somebody tried to make the Federal Reserve system into a central banking system. We are a corrupted system by the standard of our Constitution. And what I propose is very simply, go back to the credit system, to a simple credit system. The United States is the sole authority and has a monopoly on the uttering of currency or credit which leads to currency. The two things are interchangeable. Credit debt of the U.S. government cannot be created except by an act, authorization of an act of Congress. Consent of Congress. And therefore, the United States government has that debt and controls that debt. That's our system. The British system is the central bankers control the debt to the extent the governments don't interfere with it. But essentially, in principle, they control the debt. So it's a monetary system. So what happened is, when Truman took over, Truman, who would kiss the ass of Winston Churchill every moment he could, then we had imperialism again. Roosevelt's purpose was to use the credit system, and the credit system was the productive power of our war industry converted to other purposes, to free nations from colonialism, to destroy the British Empire. Roosevelt was explicit. The American system is based on destroying the British Empire. The British Empire is the official enemy of the United States, the primary permanent enemy of the United States. We don't shoot them, unless we have to. We like to torture them instead. And the best way to torture them is to tease them about their cold monetary system. Gets them very upset, and you enjoy that. You know, when Brit has a fit, you know, a hissy fit. But that's the essential thing here. So therefore, the issue is, we're talking about terms of monetary systems which are British in their conception. My point is, we have a constitution, and when the Congress and the presidency, especially the Congress, enforces the intention of our constitution, as it should, then the British are defeated. And they can only get at us by going to war against us. And in that case, we can beat them every time. So the point is, all the assumptions about this are based on the idea of a credit system. If we, the United States, say something is credit by law, it is credit. We are sovereign. We are a sovereign. Our sovereign acts create credit. Look, we had a lot of things to build. Someone says we have no money. Well, the question comes, what do we do about that? I want to build a new maglev system for the United States, all over the United States. Well, it'll take us about 20, 25 years to get that thing into place. It's going to cost a lot of money. What are we going to do? Well, Congress is going to authorize that money as credit. The use will be restricted according to law for that purpose. So we will build the system. What happens? Well, getting that credit issued means a lot of people go to work. Institutions go to work. You start to build a system. People are going to work. People begin to produce more. Wealth is being created instead of waste. and we become more productive because we do things that are going to make us more productive, as I said earlier today, in terms of the idea of the question of the top down, basic economic infrastructure. See, when you have an economy, you say, we're not going to have nuclear power, you're an idiot. You've destroyed your ability to have to create credit to increase the generation of wealth. You say, we're not going to have large-scale water systems, we're going to let the Mississippi become a hellhole, we're not going to repair it, Katrina forever, that sort of thing. We're destroying the wealth of the country, we're destroying the productivity of our people. When we invest in things that increase the productivity of our people, either directly by providing jobs that are needed and are useful and creating wealth, or by creating an infrastructural environment which has a multiplier effect on the productive powers of labor throughout the society. If I can get you to work in 1 hour a day instead of 2.5 hours a day each way, that is an increase in productivity. That's a simple thing. We are trying to increase the productive powers of labor. So therefore, the credit system operates not on the basis of fixed objects. The credit system operates on the basis of productivity. We invest in things that we are convinced will increase the productive powers of labor per capita and per square kilometer in our society. Or we do it because it's a good thing to do for other countries, which somehow will be beneficial to us in that way. But when you have a greeny mentality, as we have a disease of that type today, that's when the fungus gets in, the brain turns all green and fuzzy from this stuff. Then you say, you don't like high technology. You don't like nuclear power. You don't like high-speed transportation systems. You want crazy little cars that you can take to bed with you at night. Things like that. So therefore, what we've done, and look at our educational system, look at Harvard University. Harvard University today is hardly a center for the promotion of productivity. It may invent a new sex, but productivity never. But this sort of thing, so that's the point. The point essentially is you have to have a sense of national mission and international mission. Our mission is to be human. The difference between human beings and apes is expressed by science and classical culture. It's the improvement of the mind, the improvement of the productive powers of labor, the increase of man's standard of living, man's productivity, man's purpose in life. And it's investment in those kinds of things that are important. When a greenie comes along and say, we're going to increase productivity, we're going to disinvest in you, your ideas don't work. So we have to make that distinction. When you start talking in the monetary terms, and I understand what you're saying, the monetary terms are the pressures they're going to put on you by members of the Congress and so forth who believe in this silliness about monetary theory. That's why there's no... Look, I'm the only competent long-range forecaster in the history of the United States since I started forecasting in 1956. There's no other person who's made competent long-range forecasts in the United States on what was going to happen in the United States. I'm the only one. Why? There are other people who have competency in economic forecasting of a limited type, but this type, no. I've always been right, and they've always been wrong. And they say, but you don't predict the exact time it's going to happen. I said, this is human society. We're not a machine. We're not a machine shop. We're human beings. And you're looking at the promotion of the productive powers of labor, which means the improvement of the productive powers of labor, or the non-improvement of the productive powers of labor. And all you can forecast is the effects of one direction or the other. And I've always been right. Like I was right on the dime on this one. Last August, or July, I was on the dime. I've been on the dime again and again and again. No one else in this country has been on the dime on forecasting the way I have. Why? Because they use a different thing they call forecasting, which is not competent. But it may be competent for some things. But it's not competent for the economy. The fact, take this simple fact. 1968 to the present, fiscal year 67-68. Look at the net physical product and productivity of the United States since 1967-68. The United States, every year, every presidency, has been going to hell down the tubes. Who's been making these decisions? In government. Who in government? Economists, for example. Wall Street advisors, people from Harvard Business School, dirty business school, that sort of thing. They've been making the policies. They've been voting the policies up. Every time they vote a policy up, in general, the net effect of all policy decisions by all administrations, by all sessions of Congress, has been crap. Worse and worse and worse. Why am I a good forecaster? Because I don't believe in crap. So that's the issue here. We're using criteria in the Congress, which for 40 years have been a standard of failure, of disaster. And somebody comes along and says, you've got to go by these rules. You've got to interpret money. You've got to interpret debt, banking, by these rules. I say, crap, you're nuts. Look at the result of your applying your methods to the U.S. economy. What has the result been? Worse and worse, year by year, every year for 40 years. Now, that may not be eternity, but 40 years is a kind of an impressive figure.
Okay, Lynn, this question has been submitted by a gentleman who is the editor-in-chief of a major policy journal here in Washington and who is formerly a columnist for Business Week. He starts with a quote from Bloomberg from September 29th saying the Federal Reserve will pump an additional $630 billion into the global financial system, flooding banks with cash to alleviate the worst banking crisis since the Great Depression. And then he says, Mr. LaRouche, while the public is distracted by the bailout bill and its rejection, trillions are being pumped in to keep the financial balloon inflated. The media is falling off, the media, as if he were not part of it. The media is falling all over itself to report on every minutia of the so-called Wall Street bailout bill and its rejection by Congress yesterday. The media's breathless coverage of the bill has produced a furious backlash by the public and hysteria on Wall Street in a self-justifying feedback loop that makes the media attention seem merited. The truth is that a bailout is actually taking place as we speak, completely out of the public spotlight. This program has already pumped trillions of dollars into Wall Street compared to the mere $700 billion proposed in the legislation that the media is focusing on. This is all to help prop up the faltering investment banks and promises to keep in even more, every dime of it, to the detriment of the taxpayer, though the public will have no stake in its success. But this program is not being talked about. Slipping under the radar last week amidst the hullabaloo in Washington over the bailout bill was the story noting that in the past week alone, the Federal Reserve had pumped an astonishing $188 billion per day into the system in the form of emergency credit. This means that in just 4 days, the Fed injected as much money into the system as the entire bailout proposal. After the proposal was rejected, the Fed apparently responded by immediately announcing that it would pour another $630 billion into the global financial system. The Federal Reserve conjures the reassuring image of a national bank lending out some of its vast reserves to help Wall Street weather the storm. But the fact is that the Federal Reserve is not federal and it has doubtful reserves right now. In fact, the trillions of dollars that have been lent to the banks in the last few weeks were created out of nothing by the privately owned Federal Reserve. When the Federal Reserve lends money to a bank through repurchase agreements, credit auction, or other methods, it's not actually lending out money from its vaults. It is simply creating the money it lends out as electronic credits created in the recipient bank accounts. It is literally money out of thin air. That the general public is on the hook for this money created out of nothing is really no exaggeration, but nobody seems to understand this. My question to you is, how do they manage to pull this off? And why is that bailout different from what Mr. Paulson is proposing?
Again, we have to think in battlefield terms, not in accounting terms. There's a creep called Michael Milken. He was an organized crime operative during the 1970s and 1980s, who went to jail ultimately for his practices. However, when the crash of Wall Street occurred in 1987, October 87, after that in came Alan Greenspan. Now, Alan Greenspan made the methods of Michael Milken the heart and soul of the Federal Reserve System. Now, what's this wake? It's fake money. It's fake debt. And I have a nice solution for this fake debt thing. What they do is they will create an agreement that I owe you. I will pay you so much a year. Now somebody turns around and says, what's that, 7% rate, 8% rate, what? Okay, so multiply the value of this agreement as that multiple of the agreement. Now you say, I now have an asset, this agreement to pay so much a year, which I've capitalized at, say, 11 times the price of the annual payment. Great, huh? Now what you do is you keep doing that, is what Alan Greenspan did. Therefore, he's violated the federal constitution. The Federal Reserve, to the extent that he uses that method, has violated the federal constitution on the credit system. All of that money is legally worthless when we get the government to declare it worthless. When I'm talking about reform, I'm not talking about working within the system of this present system of the Michael Milken, Alan Greenspan system. I believe, and I think other people believe, that what we're going to do with those gentlemen at our leisure is put them in jail. Because that is a lie. There is no value in this stuff. So we are being asked to pay for garbage called toxic waste. Toxic waste is the day that somebody discovers this fictitious claim against the system as a capital amount is no longer being paid on current payment, or will no longer be paid. So suddenly, this balloon of fictitious, this is all monopoly play money, which is coming in and competing with an overwhelming real money, that is legal money, which is that which is created by approval of the Federal Reserve System through the control of the Federal Reserve System by the federal government. But the federal government is no longer controlled, or the Federal Reserve System has not been controlled by the federal government. It's been controlled by Alan Greenspan and Alan Greenspan's international London friends. This is a swindle. This is thievery. There's no legitimacy to it. Why should we pay it? But you see, the point is, we are a lawful system. Therefore, we don't just not pay something unless we have a clear case that it's criminal or fraudulent. What we do under our system, we say, we put it under scrutiny. We put the thing in bankruptcy reorganization proceedings. We now take the part that we are sure is valid, and we allow that part to function. We increase the amount of that part. We decrease the other part. The fictitious function, in the meanwhile, is not collecting any rent. So therefore, we get rid of it. See, what has been done to us over these years, especially since 1971, especially since 1981, has been a crime against the nation, a crime of the quality of a crime against humanity. Look at the suffering that's been caused by this system, of the stealing from people, of the ruining of their society, of the corruption of their children, all these things. Isn't that a crime? Well, but we don't deal with this arbitrarily. We don't take these guys out and shoot them. We're not Nazis. We say, come please gently into this little room, which is now be your habitation for the next few years. You're going to be fed. You're going to be cared for. We've got medical care. You've got everything you need. You're just not going to be able to keep all that fake money that you printed. And we may be looking at some of the assets you think you have as a result of that money. Maybe they really, that those assets may really belong to somebody else, like the stockholders you robbed. So that's the way we proceed. Once you get that thing clearly in view, that's the way we're proceeding, then your head is clear. Money is that which is legal. Legality is determined by constitutional principle. But we're always fair. Anybody has a legitimate beef, we hear it. We're not dilatory in this thing, but it takes time. And therefore, in the meantime, please be patient. We won't take more time to clean up the case than it took you to steal.
Okay, Lynn, this is a question from, how shall I describe him, a pollster, a political consultant and a pollster. Says, Lynn, as I know you know, the U.S. Congress was more than happy to rubber stamp the bailout until their constituents got wind of what was up. A good number of House members voted no on Monday because they feared what their constituents would do to them if they didn't. Amazingly, even though the House seemed to do what the people wanted and voted no, our polls show that Congress's approval rating still declined to below 9% in the wake of that vote. Like the financial system, it would seem that these guys are screwed if they do and screwed if they don't. Now, some of us might take a moment to revel in the sadistic pleasure of this. But then, upon reflection, it occurs that this lynch mob environment could also be dangerous. I'd appreciate your thoughts on this.
Of course it's dangerous. That's what I said. Where's the danger come from? From the people who are angry? From the people who are not angry enough to stop this nonsense. As I've said repeatedly over the recent days, you're dealing with something which is a French Revolution type situation. You have, on the one hand, you have the people, and the people are enraged because they know that everything is being taken away from them. Why aren't you stopping that? Why aren't you protecting the people? You're the government. Why aren't you protecting the people? Why do you let this happen to them? Look what's happened to their health care. Look at what's happened to everything. Their jobs, their communities, everything is gone. You've robbed them. They're angry. And they know, especially with the performance of the Congress in the past 2 years, from February 62 to February 60 to 92, the day, that they've been robbed. The Congress has done nothing for them. The people who were elected in the last congressional election, they went into Congress, as some of these who sent this message earlier, and they've been betrayed under Pelosi. Nobody paid any attention to what they were in Congress to clean up. They just shut them off. Look at all the things they've lost and are losing. Nothing is being done for them. And you have these guys, it's typical of governments that are about to fall in history generally. Here you've got people up, you have the swine who are doing the stealing, the robbery, and so forth. But then you have the people who say, you have to go along to get along, don't you understand? People have to be more patient with us. It's going to take more time. Be more patient with us. It's wrong to be so insulting. You insult these people, they're going to be nasty. You've got to be nice to them while you're being patient. and they're losing everything.
So when do we take the streets?
We don't have to take the streets. We're on the streets. I'm in the streets for you right now. I'm in the streets. I put my life on the line here. They are out to kill people like me. And I tell, kill me. I defy you. And if I defy you, if someone like me has the guts to stand up to these guys, maybe others will. If I don't have the guts to stand up, no one will. You have to have articulate, intelligent leadership and fight against this time. But you have to, you know, like what happened to Herrhausen, the banker in Germany. The French killed him on orders of Margaret Thatcher and with the approval of George H.W. Bush. And coal collapsed. And Germany has become increasingly a slave state ever since then, as a result of these Maastricht conditions, which were imposed by George Bush, George H.W. Bush, the father of this idiot, imposed by Mitterrand of France, who was an old enemy of mine, in a sense he's now dead. He's down in where he belongs now. And this sort of thing, so we have to fight. And you have to have intelligent fighting. You have to have leadership on what, in terms of what the remedies are, and fight for the remedies, not fight for vengeance. Vengeance is a lousy cause to fight for. You fight for justice. And if you're in a leading position as I am and know these things when other people don't, it's my job to do my job. To provide the leadership you need because of my knowledge, period, that's it. The rest of it's up to you.
Let me also just point out that the way most of you got here and the way that most of the people who are listening online came to listen is precisely because members of the LaRouche movement, and particularly the LaRouche youth movement, have been conducting educationals in the streets for quite some time. And anytime any of you are inclined to join us in the street doing precisely that, believe me, your participation is more than welcome. Okay, then the next question is from a black state senator. And what he says is, Lynn, I don't know if you're aware of it, but last week when the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation held its annual meeting in Washington, there was not one single workshop on the financial crisis. The closest they came to it was a counseling workshop on how to renegotiate your mortgage. On September 28th, I heard Green Party candidate Cynthia McKinney make the claim that during Hurricane Katrina, 5,000 people were executed. She says these were mainly black men who may have been incarcerated at the time Katrina struck, and while they were not necessarily shot, that they were allowed to die. The fact of the matter is that when I heard that from her, I rolled my eyes and said, "There goes Cynthia." But the fact of the matter is that watching the way the government is responding to this current crisis, I'm really beginning to wonder if black people in the United States shouldn't begin to worry about attempted genocide. You addressed this question obliquely by saying that the Bush administration was prepared to use troops against the US population. I'm asking you this because I want to really get a better sense from you whether you are saying this as hyperbole or metaphor or whether you think it's actually true.
I mean, it's actually true. It may not have happened yet, but its potentiality is already organized. And it's organized in ways that you can't mistake what's going on. And I'm not the only one who's observed it. That's why some people are frightened. As you've seen, we referred to that today. People in high positions, sometimes very high positions, are terrified. afraid they're going to be shot or put into concentration camp by this government over these issues. It's real. And when you look at the record of the current president's grandfather, the guy who moved the money to get the Nazi party out of bankruptcy in time to make Hitler dictator of Germany, you shouldn't have much trouble in understanding what there is inside certain parts of this government. And I can tell you, if this government turns in that direction, it will not survive. You cannot get by with doing that to the American people. These will fight harder than Iraqis. They'll fight harder than Vietnamese. You want to stop that kind of war? You won't win it. The United States may be destroyed, but you won't win it. You won't be destroyed. So you better give up this damn bailout.
Okay, I do want to try to start to take some of the international questions, because we have a number of questions from PRD congressmen in Mexico. We have questions from Colombia, from Argentina, and elsewhere. So why don't we take some of those, and then we can come back to the United States. This is from Mexico, Lynn. And the question is, Mr. LaRouche, how did you manage to foresee this crisis as far back as the 1970s?
Well, I've been in the forecasting business for a long time. I actually implicitly started at economics as such when I, after doing some studies I was doing, and hit upon the work of Bernard Riemann in physics, and I saw this way to solve and understand certain problems which had not been properly understood in economics earlier. I was actually a very good management consultant and executive for a management consulting firm in the 1950s, and did that also at other times. I had a rather extraordinary talent in this sort of thing, which got me into trouble with certain right-wing institutions inside the US government, which is why I sort of left management consulting. It was getting precarious. The FBI was following me around. So, in any case, so I did these long-range studies on the basis of the kinds of considerations which I've reflected here, which come essentially from looking at economic processes from the standpoint of physical economy. Remember that economy is not based on money value. Money is an instrument of credit that governments properly use, because transactions among people occur among individual to individual or individual to institution. And therefore, you cannot simply predetermine by any fiat system how prices should be determined. So what you do is you set up a fair trade system, is what we called it in the 1950s, a fair trade system where you have caps on prices, lower and higher caps. You have certain kinds of protection. For example, Kennedy put through a bill with for investment in capital improvements. That is, if a company which makes a profit would invest in a machine tool or something of that sort, out of its retained capital, the tax on the retain of that portion of capital would be at a lower rate than if they went out and bought stock on the open market. This kind of thing. We set up systems. So the idea was always with money was to use the federal control over the creation and regulation of money as a way of encouraging the flows in the right direction, so that you were getting more of the things you wanted in terms of results and less of the things you didn't want. It was protections in the sense of trade protection. If an American firm creates an industry which is useful to the United States, we're not going to allow dumping prices to put that firm out of business. We're going to protect that firm. Somebody in the United States, as a citizen, invested in creating something which is productive. It's useful to the United States. We're not going to let somebody from the outside come in and dump on this firm and shut this firm down by competitive methods. It's not fair to the foreigner either. Because as you see, in the case of China, China suffers a crisis today of U.S. beneficence, in a sense, in giving them all this opportunity. But what is the price for China? Well, China is allowed to get certain things and not others. And China must produce at prices which it cannot maintain its own whole population. So therefore, China's in a situation where it now depends upon largely U.S. business. What it gets in terms of money out of this business, which it takes, again, away from the United States, it's exported into China, as industry is there, is not enough to keep China alive. China has many poor. The problem in Asia is many poor. And what are you doing to enable them to increase their... Well, China needs investment in its local community. It needs investments in its industries. But it doesn't get enough paid from the United States. But what's the reason for that? Well, they get paid less than the U.S. industry would get. By doing that, they undercut the U.S. industry in the market. They shut down the U.S. industry, and they end up getting less from the production than the U.S. industry was getting when it was doing the production. So what you're doing is you're lowering the income of the planet. Not just the money income, you're lowering the physical income of the people of the planet. So you're giving China an opportunity to have some billionaires, Communist Party billionaires even, but you still have created a situation in which China is under a threat from its dependency upon this business with the United States. And the same thing is true of the policy with India, the British policy, same thing. So therefore, the protectionism against this kind of problem is a primary consideration. And that's the problem here. We have to have a system of fair trade, what we call fair trade back in the 1950s, where we come to an agreement with nations on fair trade levels. The way we set fair trade levels is by taking any part of the planet and saying, what does it actually require in physical skills, in development, to produce something of a certain quality? Well, that's a fair price then. That's a fair price. Now, every country, if they want to compete, can compete at that price. We also have certain other protectionism to make sure that the industries don't run away, because that collapses the economy. So what we are out to do is to set up a fair trade system through international credit for large-scale projects, as in over Eurasia, vast projects, power, everything. And that is, we're going to protect that. The United States is going to protect the Chinese interest in that just as much as it protects the U.S. interest in its industry. Russia, same thing. India, the same thing. We are going to have a protectionist world based on a fair estimate of what it actually takes in physical cost to produce something of a certain quality. And whatever that physical cost is of the best performance, that will be the standard of price. And we'll try to find that by feeling our way around it, and which is what was called a fair trade system. It was based on people coming in for firms that were producing things and saying, this is fair trade for us. Sometimes it was abused, but that depends on how good government is, how efficient government is. There are a lot of questions can be raised about that, but I think that's a fair answer to them.
And this is another question from a PRD congressman in Mexico. Mr. LaRouche, in Mexico, people are saying that what's happening now in the U.S. is an American FOBAPROA, which is the massive government bailout of Mexico's bankrupt banks in the 1990s. What do you say Why do you say that that's not the case, and what are the implications?
Well, what we require, remember, I had a collaboration with President López Portillo of Mexico during the spring of that year, but it also had antecedents with Mexico for a long time. And what we came up with as a reform in Mexico was a good one. And Henry Kissinger was sent down to shut that down. And Mexico has been raped by that ever since. Now, we've got an interesting situation now, is that we brought a lot of semi-slave labor into the United States from Mexico when we wanted it. Then, for ideological as well as other reasons, economic reasons, we're now shipping that labor back, and then we're throwing out people on the basis of being throwing out immigrants and as illegal and so forth. So now you reality strikes, as in the Plano region of Mexico, as an exemplary problem, where what should have been done, what was being done earlier under the López Portillo government, this has to be done now. Because as a matter of security of the hemisphere and security of our borders, we have to cooperate in the United States with the government of Mexico on this thing, not by this or that thing. We have to think about what can be done when people are being thrown back out of the United States into these parts of Mexico, largely northern Mexico. What can be done to ensure that there is a place of employment, a relevant kind of employment, of benefit to Mexico and to these people? So therefore, we were discussing this with López Portillo earlier, on similar things about how do we deal with this cross-border migration problem. And it could be managed. But we have to cooperate with Mexico from the United States in our own interest. Because what is good for Mexico is good for us. And we know that, or we should know it. So therefore, this comes up again. We time a crisis. There is a resurgence in South and Central America. And Mexico, of course, is really Central America. It's not South America. There are certain differences. But throughout the hemisphere, there's a drive toward resurgence, toward rebuilding. And we in the United States, as Roosevelt would have done from his time, we have a vital interest in close cooperation with each of these countries and with groups of countries on defining projects where we can cooperate to the benefit of all concerned. We're looking essentially for stability. We're looking for stability through economic progress, infrastructure, and so forth. And also the drug problem is big. And one of our big problems, of course, is George Soros, who is one of the biggest operatives in terms of drug trafficking operations in that whole region. But it is the vital interest of the United States, not a goodie, we're going to trade off and make concessions. This is in our interest, whether Mexico raised the question or not. It's in our interest that Mexicans who are thrown back across the border in particular have access to this kind of opportunity as a benefit to Mexico as a whole, as a nation. And then as a byproduct, as a benefit to our relations with Mexico. The same thing applies throughout the entire hemisphere. We must get back to Franklin Roosevelt's conception. These are our neighbors. And our neighborhood depends upon our relationship to those neighbors. And we have to work together to define objectives and projects that are going to solve that problem.
Lynn, the next question comes from an official in Argentina. Hello, Mr. LaRouche. Greetings from Argentina. To date, almost the totality of the central bank reserves are in currencies, and most especially in dollars. In addition to your proposals for reforming the international financial system, what measures should individual governments adopt as regards their own central bank reserves? since currently the old disabled horse of George Soros's financial system continues doing its thing in Ibero-America.
Okay, what we need is we need to set up a global system. And we cannot set up a global system without cooperation with Russia and a group of other countries. The United States and Russia's cooperation is absolutely crucial to organizing these relationships among nations generally. Now, when we start from the assumption of Russia and the United States as being a pivotal element of bringing a group of leading nations together and then expanding it, we then have to look at regions of the world. For example, Africa is a region of the world. The British are killing Africans. We got to throw the British out of Africa. Therefore, we have to have a special policy involving Europe, involving Asian countries. China's already involved significantly, especially on the East Coast, and in Africa, for this development project for Africa as such. We have to have a protectionist screen around that project. We have, for South America, we have the same thing. These are closely related nations in many ways, culturally and otherwise. And therefore, we have to have an understanding of what are the standard of a fixed exchange rate system within the terms of the Americas, as for Africa, as for the world as a whole. So we need to build up a sense of what is a fair fixed rate system for each of these regions. This idea of a fixed rate system has to be correlated with, especially with large-scale infrastructure projects and other kinds of development projects. So therefore, you have an interest, your foreign policy interest, again, is an extension of the peace of Westphalia. The benefit of the other, the interest of the United States is being, strategically, the most beneficial organization in the world to other nations, is what we once were. The nation which is most beneficial to most other nations. That's the fundamental interest of the United States, which comes directly from the Peace of Westphalia of 1648. That's the law. And therefore, we have to go into these countries saying, we are here to discover what your best interest is and to help you achieve it. That should be our foreign policy. With that foreign policy, we have a safe world. Or we can get one. And in the case of South America, it's the same thing. We have mapped major projects in South America, infrastructure, water projects, so forth. We know these projects, not perfectly, but we know them in general. I know them in general. We must do these things. And we must do that also in Africa. We must do that also in Asia and elsewhere.
Okay, we have time to take at least a few more questions. Lynn, this question, actually, I'm going to turn it into a composite question because we have a number of questions coming in from activists around the United States who were involved in Hillary Clinton's campaign for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And they are now involved in a fight to try to restore democratic principles to the Democratic Party. What they ask more or less, and I'm going to start with this question and inject something from a couple of others. She says, Lynn, as I've been watching the disgusting role played by Democratic congressional leaders Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid to push through the bailout, I keep asking, where are the real leaders of our party? While it's gratifying that the House of Representatives voted no, and that many of those who did vote no were Democrats, I also heard many people who I like and respect making speeches about how bad the bailout was and then announcing that they were going to vote for it. My question to you again, where are the real leaders of our party? Why are they not speaking out? Surely somebody in addition to you has some idea of what to do.
Well, you know, you've seen, I think, if you've been following this webcast and the exchanges that have been going across the lines from here, you get some sense of what the problem is. The problem is there are very few people who have the confidence and temperament to be leaders of the type needed in this situation. My job, essentially on this account, is to define a paradigm to which other people can relate for just exactly this reason. I have to set an example for what leadership is. Because if you see, and many of the questions which have come in as querulous in some sense on this question of bailout, shows that the best leaders we have in top-ranking positions in the United States are not really fully qualified to lead. That's why they ask me these questions this way. Because they're saying, yes, but, yes, but, yes, but. I have to provide, at my age of all places, I have to provide this standard of leadership for this nation. Because I know there's no one else presently who will do what I'm doing. That is, do it and be competent to do it. And at my age, it's difficult to add on other tasks as well as this, to do this job properly. But I must do it. And I would hope that in doing it, we will bring forth, as I know they're out there, people who are not necessarily recognized as being leaders in the field, but who will become that. And generally, you'll find that mostly among people between 25 and 35 years of age. You'll find some older people play a key role. But the fighting spirit on the line of leadership is generally from that generation of people who have those qualifications. They're young, they're energetic, they still want to grow. They have not satisfied, they've grown thoroughly, as some people mistakenly assume later on. So the growth and progress of a core, a cadre core, of people in the 25 to 35 age group, and younger people who become up with them, that's the answer for leadership now. I have to do my job, and especially because there's a paucity of people who will do what I do. I'm necessary, unfortunately. But therefore, if I act, maybe somebody else will find the guts to act who has the qualifications to do it.
This is another question from somebody who actually is a Democratic strategist. Mr. LaRue, shortly after the convention, after both conventions, you once again commented that the candidates of the moment were not necessarily the candidates we'd have when we went to the polls in November. At the time, that seemed ridiculous, but now there is significant motion, I am told, among ranking Republicans to replace Sarah Palin as the vice president nominee. And my understanding is that this is a very serious movement. I don't know whether it will succeed or not. However, I would like you to comment on it because it does seem to me to be rather unprecedented.
I don't know. Maybe the opposition to her comes from the order of the moose, you know? I mean, a caribou, you know. She's terrified of caribou. They might shoot back or something. Or that she thinks they're too horny for her with a new incarnation. our problem is, I mean, our basic problem, again, is a question of developing leadership. Now, I've been trying to do this, and I think at this point, just insert it, because I haven't said so before. What I've been trying to do is develop a youth leadership of people essentially from about 20 on up, you know, that age group, young adults. And we have learned a lot in the process of this. We have developed a scientific orientation such that I think that people who've been through this a little bit in a few years are doing better than people certainly in universities, advanced universities generally. And what's needed is to have confidence, you have to have competence. And to have competence, you have to have a method of developing competence. I think the hope for this nation in the longer run, which is the way I think we should locate what's needed in the shorter run, is to develop a generation in the 25-35 age group which has an orientation towards science and classical culture. Now, we're doing certain things in music, for example, which we've made integral to our work in developing a youth movement, classical musical program. We run into all the problems and difficulties in carrying this thing forward, but I watch it all the time, and we're doing some interesting things. We're not doing badly. We often are doing something which nobody else is doing, but they should be doing. In terms of physical science, our universities are deadheads. Harvard is a disaster, absolute disaster. Other universities that we have called leading universities are absolute disasters in science. They have no scientific competence anymore. Maybe somebody in there does. Some person buried in an attic up there, so they let him out on some festive occasions. But in general, what's coming out of the universities is pure ideology. Remember, this is a nation which no longer produces. We no longer really manufacture products. We BS is the name. You've got a BS degree. You know what that means. It's a big problem. And we're having some success in that, but we have to realize that what we're doing with all the shortcomings that come up in our efforts is that we're filling a gap. There is no competent conception of science generically in these universities. Why? Because there's no orientation to production in this society. Get it cheap from abroad. It's an import. Nobody wants to produce anymore. Not really. Not competitively develop an industry. Not to make scientific breakthroughs. Not to produce new kinds of products. This kind of thing. Maybe a few odd people like me around like that sort of thing. But we're not doing that. We're not organizing the society around that. And I would think that this future lies not sometimes in having an accomplished cadre of the type you would like to have, but a commitment to trying to develop that kind of cadre, which gives you give a future orientation to society. I think it'd work. But if we have a problem in Russia, a different kind of problem, but it's similar. Russia used to have a very important scientific capability. It was poorly reflected in manufacturing, normally in product. It was well represented in military applications of scientific applications, which is often much ahead of the United States in this area. But they too have a problem there. Most countries have a problem of this type. They have something in Japan left, they have something in Korea left, and so forth. But we are short of that kind of understanding which enables us to understand what production is, for example. What do we mean by production? What do we mean by increasing the actual wealth of society for mankind's needs? That's lost. It's largely lost. And so I think that really the orientation toward developing that, a classical musical orientation, a classical scientific orientation, embedded in people who are fighting to save society from its own self-inflicted perils, is the way to define the way to go. You've got a lot of young people out there in the 25-35 group and younger, and they really don't know what to do. They're bright people, they would like to be something. They have problems because their parents, neglected them in a certain way, or possessed them too much when they do. So they don't know what to do. So therefore, the first step in getting them to know what to do is to get them oriented to what they should discover what to do. And that's what we're doing. And I think those of us who are older, who are fighting to try to save civilization now, as I am, we think, if we're wise, we think about the time after we're dead. We think about 20, 30, 40 years after we've died. And have we set into motion in our lifetime the impetus, the direction of self-development of a future generation so that we never let society fall into the hands, as disgusting as the baby boomer generation has manifested itself to be.
Well, while we continue to get a significant number of questions pouring in, we've reached that point in the webcast where the questions fall into three categories. One category are the questions coming from Washington, where people are saying, but, Mr. LaRouche, and I'm not going to go through those. The second group are questions coming from an odd group of people who want to know things like what Mr. LaRouche's policy is to save the baby seals. And I can assure you he has compassion for them. And then the third group are people, and these represent the majority of the communiques that are coming in, that basically say that Lynn is better than Jesus Christ, FDR, Martin Luther King, Elvis, and the Beatles all rolled up into one. And he already knows that, so. So I'm going to close with one question, which is kind of a composite of several questions that have come in, many of them from members of the LIM. Lynn, it's ironic that we're in the middle of a presidential campaign, and both the leading candidates seem to be irrelevant in this fight. Given the disaster that the two leading candidates represent, can you please speak in closing to the ability to make policy through the broader institution of the presidency, beyond simply the individual who happens to occupy the White House, since it does seem that that institution is what is going to have to function? I guess my real question is, how do we move this thing, and where do we go from today?
If you think of the history of the United States and its presidents, you don't think anymore in terms of what you think of a president, and the term president means in Europe. It's completely different. Our presidency is actually our government. And now I have a lot of dealings with our government, some very good, with various institutions over years. I've done things with our government. I've been essentially a part of our government in my function. It may not be obvious to some people, but yes, I'm behind the scenes. I'm involved behind the scenes and have been for a long time. And I do some moving and shaking at times inside that process, sometimes successfully, sometimes less so. But I understand this government probably better than any presidential candidate now running loose, or likely to run loose. This institution of the presidency is not an individual institution of a mortal individual. It has a sacred function. It is the central pivot of our entire state and our entire society. Which means you've got a bum president. That doesn't mean he runs the country. It means that there are processes in society which are oriented to the concept of the presidency, not the personality of a particular president. Sometimes in our history, but fairly rarely in the whole history of the United States, the incumbent president has really been a significant representation of the presidency. You see, the president is there. He comes and he goes. But then you have all these institutions around that president and the presidency, and they're still there. They were there for a couple, three generations. They're there. Because for a presidency to function, it requires all these people who impact the presidency. Some of them are not in government anymore, but they're still part of the presidency. They exert a very important influence. For example, when a president or a presidency wants to make a policy, they reach out to people who may have been outside government and reach out regularly. And these people are considered part of the spirit of the making of policy of the US government, even though they're outside government now. So there's a continuity or multi-generational continuity of the concept of the presidency as a characteristic of the U.S. government. And the other institutions like the Senate and the House of Representatives are essential auxiliaries of the presidency. We are a presidential system. We are not a parliamentary system. And the system is bigger than the president. And therefore, we function, when we function at all, in terms not of the president, but of the presidency. And all those people in the United States who are part of the deliberative process, which is the president of the United States, including the House of Representatives, which is a check on the presidency in some respects, but it's also part of it. The Senate is a check on the presidency in part, but it's also part of it. So we have a conception, not a Cartesian conception of parts of government, but a Riemannian conception of a Leibnizian conception. And this was our concept of government was specifically based on Leibniz. We have a Leibnizian government in conception. It's dynamic. All the parts function together, not as parts rubbing against each other or bouncing like each other, ricochet. And that's what we have to keep a focus on. The dead live within us in the presidency. John Quincy Adams made contributions to the presidency which are living today and are part of the deliberative process. Abraham Lincoln is living today. George Washington is living today. Hamilton is living today. Many key figures are living today. Roosevelt's living today. And people are still trying to kill him. like George Soros and company. Kill him. So that's what you have to understand. We are immortal. There's a concept in theology, especially in Christian theology, which is extremely relevant here. The idea of the simultaneity of eternity. That we live as mortal human beings in such a way that when our bodies die on us, we still live, but in a way, different way. We live and our living is expressed by our influence on the processes around us, a radiating influence. Even, you know, it's expressed simply like the children dedicated to the memory of a grandparent's devotion, or the memory of a hero in the family, a member of the hero in the neighborhood. In various ways, the ideas, the concept formation processes of earlier generations are reflected in the living today. And the presidency of the United States is conceived to be that kind of institution, something which is a repository of a simultaneity of eternity, with a role in the universe, a role in this planet, for all humanity. We just don't exist just for ourselves, to protect ourselves, our own property. We exist to try to make this planet a better place to live, and this nation an instrument to make this planet a better place to live, and a better future for humanity. Our institutions should be living in a simultaneity of eternity, such that we are contributing something for the future. We are responding to a responsibility we've had from the past, and thus the dead now live in us through this aspect, and we live in turn in those yet to be born. And that's what the presidency is, when somebody really understands it. When you understand Lincoln, when you understand John Quincy Adams, when you understand Benjamin Franklin above all, you understand that. So we need to look at not the individual president, like this piece of crap we have now. You look at the institution of the presidency as an immortal institution in a simultaneity of eternity, with a mission on this planet for humanity as a whole, not merely our own affairs, and to make our citizens worthwhile people. Just to make our citizens good, to develop, is a good for all humanity. And the development of that kind of conception is what is essential. And I think very few people in this age of the baby boomer still have that understanding. I know when I was younger, that understanding did exist. It was, people were, would resonate to that. Today, very few. But we must capture a sense of the simultaneity need of eternity and see the presidency of the United States in those terms of reference.
Well, my friends, I would urge you to keep checking the website for updates and for instructions, since obviously this is a very critical period, and I think that things will change hour to hour. I would also urge all of you to use the organizing materials that are posted on the website in your local area. That's what they're there for. If you've been sitting on the sidelines, cut it out. We need you. Keep the pressure up on Congress, keep in touch, send money, and above all, please join me on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of people who have tuned into this webcast and who will be tuning into it over the course of the rest of today in thanking Lynn for an absolutely extraordinary presentation.
Thank you.